But yeah, so I did get to sleep, and then I woke up really early, and then eventually got back to sleep, and finally like woke up, like, better hurry up and get going. And I noticed the arising of a desire for coffee coming out of the Alaya Vijnana. And then right after it came a memory that there is no coffee left. And then like a kind of feeling of annoyance. And then another memory that I had been to the co-op, I stopped at the co-op last night to buy like apples and eggs and something, and I didn't buy coffee. So then more annoyance arose, and kind of like recrimination, sort of feeling like, you know, you should. And then I kind of noticed all this was happening, and I could stop, you know, breathe a little bit, set it down a little bit, remind myself it's normal to forget things, you know, to try to sort of like plant a little seed of, I don't know what, forgiveness, normalizing, you know, acceptance. And then once that kind of had cleared, the memory came up that I just bought a really great Assam tea, and that would be great, you know, that's no problem. So it's funny, you know, in the mind, isn't it? And I think the great sort of potentiality of this teaching is, you know, not to get like all obsessed about all this, but that it really matters how we use our mind. It really matters that we notice what's arising, that we respond, that however we respond to it, you know, whatever happens, any experience of body, speech, and mind is somehow the germination of these seeds, according to these teachings, according to conditions, you know, waking up, groggy, you know, conditions. And that the way we respond moment to moment to moment to moment to moment is tossing more seeds back in there, which are going to be there. They're going to be there. They're going to be there waiting for us, you know, waiting for the next time when conditions are right for them to germinate. So even though we're in the privacy of our own home, and actually I was, Walker and Janet are at a family reunion, so I had this rare weekend in the house alone. And it's funny the way we do have this idea that if other people are around, I should behave one way. On my own, I get to behave another way. So obviously it doesn't make a whole lot of sense in this frame, you know. So other people are not, so I'm on my own, so that gives me a great opportunity to plant some really unwholesome seeds, you know, great, you know? Nice. So the simple version of how to work with this seems to be more or less, one, think of what's arising as a manifesting seed. Like just experiment with thinking of it that way, you know. Two, meet that manifestation, whatever it is, with mindfulness, you know, knowing what's here, and with some kindness, if you can muster it. Three, see if you can plant a wholesome seed in response to whatever's arising. Or at least refrain, you know, refrain from planting a new unwholesome seed. Four, I can print this out for you too, I made a nice little list. Four, if you do plant an unwholesome seed, then run this whole process on that, you know. Oh, here I am planting an unwholesome seed, right? But the thing to recognize then is that at least mindfulness has arisen, so that's to be celebrated, you know. That I'm here telling myself what a dumb person I am or how inadequate I am. But by the virtue of practice and the incredible potential of the human mind, I actually noticed I was doing that. So we can meet even the planting of unwholesomeness with a wholesome response, right? With mindfulness and with kindness. And five, we might notice, or we might wonder, I guess, if there might be an overemphasis in the mind on the circumstances, you know, the conditions that have facilitated the germinating of this particular seed. And with the afflictive emotions, we usually call whatever that is a trigger, right? A trigger. Which is kind of like halfway to this teaching, I think, you know. It's not exactly that they made me upset, they were the trigger. But still making the trigger a big deal, you know. Maybe it is and maybe it isn't, but I think these teachings encourage us to wonder, am I overemphasizing that? Is too much attention going to the circumstances, to the trigger, to whatever it is? Then six, this is like, you know, the masterclass level. So we can also get curious about, well, how do we know How did we know that trigger was here? How do we perceive whatever these conditions are that seem to have facilitated this seed germinating? So can we get curious about the actual perception? You know what I mean? The actual moment of perception. Because that's the other input, right? The sense consciousness, this is our perceiving things, which are somehow setting up conditions of the mind that Manas hears about. And I'm kind of thinking about like this little barrier between conscious and unconscious. It's like a... I'm thinking about it like gossip. So Manas kind of hears the gossip, you know, that the ear consciousness told the mind consciousness that so-and-so, you know, said some mean thing about us, you know, right? And so the Manas goes running as fast as she can down into Laya Vijnana to find the appropriate seeds, you know. Like, I know what to do, you know. Anger, yeah, here's a bunch, you know. Goes to the garden shed, gets the watering can. The Miracle-Gro, gets the Miracle-Gro. You know. And so we're, you know, this seems to be where we are, if we're anywhere in this thing. So since we're in the junction of all this stuff happening, you know, we do have some influence. You know, Manas is going to do what Manas is going to do. The seeds are there. But if Manas is learning about this from the gossip, we're the gossiper, you know, we're the ones sending out the gossip. So Manas may still infer, you know, if we try to say, everything's fine, you know, Manas is very subtle and very aware and can hear our tone, read between the lines. And, you know, even if we very maturely said, I know that she didn't mean that, and I'm bigger than that, Manas still knows that we're pissed off, you know. And she still can germinate the right seed, so. So that's this morning's summary of all this stuff. So let's read some more verses. Go ahead, Chris.
Does becoming intimate with what's going on enter into somewhere?
Right, yeah, that's the last thing I was saying, which I'm going to focus on this afternoon. So the intimacy is with, you know, these interactions, and especially with the object of perception, that we take an object of perception and we add a lot to it, right? The mind consciousness adds from its own sort of store of memories and ideas. And so the intimate, I think the most accessible intimacy, like you're talking about, Chris, is to be more intimate with the senses as they unfold moment to moment to moment, you know. It's like the Buddha said to that monk, which I'll find for this afternoon, you know. You can relax, Badia, because in the herd, there's only the herd. It's all you need, you know, just to be with what is. But yeah, exactly. So it's not, yeah, exactly. That's, I'm glad you said this. This isn't a matter of, like, skill. We're good at skill thinking. Oh, good, a new skill. We'll figure this out, you know. So it's not exactly about skill, I don't think. It's about presence and intimacy and patience and curiosity. And, you know, I suppose there is a skill to that. But the basis of all this is not skill. Like the Dogen reminded us yesterday morning, something like, you know, what is he saying there? It's not a matter of skill and intelligence, and I forget the exact phrases he uses. Does that pop into your mind? Intelligence or lack of it does not matter. There you go. So, yeah. So if, you know, if we forget all this by tomorrow, it's okay. Intelligence or lack of it does not matter. But maybe we can wonder about the seeds. So Thich Nhat Hanh has about 10 verses for us on Manas. So I thought we'd go through those fairly snappily. We're not too snappy, but it's fairly snappily. And then do another exercise about our inner voice. So verse 16, I think, is next. Seeds of delusion give rise to the internal formations of craving and afflictions. These forces animate our consciousness as mind and body manifest themselves. So all our ancient twisted karma, you know, from beginning of greed, hate, and delusion, has planted these seeds, and when they come up, they manifest as craving and afflictions, and those are powerful forces. So I think this is a nice verse just to remind us that, you know, we're up against a big, powerful force, the momentum of which is from beginningless time and across beginningless space and involves every living being, you know. So, you know, it's not going to, like, go away overnight. And so that being the case, in verse 17 he says, with store consciousness as its support, usually they say as its basis, but as its support, manas arises. Its function is mentation. Grasping the seeds, it considers to be self. Well, I had to look up mentation, which is a kind of archaic English word that means thinking. And he says in the text that he's translating the word, the Sanskrit word manana, and I looked that up too, and that also means thinking. So I don't know why he said mentation. I think part of the challenge of all this is that in English, we, you know, again, we kind of assume one consciousness and one thinking is kind of one thing. But here there's all these consciousnesses. So he's trying to tell us that manas has its own intelligence. It's not the same as our conscious awareness. It's not the same. We don't actually know what manas is thinking, but the manas has a way of thinking about all this. And that its primary topic, or its only topic, I guess, is self, you know, is me. You know, how do I understand this as part of me and something I did or was done to me or shouldn't have been done, you know, me. Let's see. He says in there that manas can grasp at self or grasp at non-self, which is interesting. We don't think of that. And elsewhere in the Pali, somewhere in the Pali Canon, there's apparently only one place that the Buddha ever answered the question, is there a self? Some monk asked him, is there a self? Because he's got this teaching of not self. You'd think he would have been talking about it day and night, but he didn't. He mostly talked about practices, you know. And the Buddha responded, well, to say that there is a self is an extreme view that will not lead, you know, to freedom. As a standard formula, he says, will not lead to dispassion and freedom from suffering. So to say that there is a self is an extreme view. And to say that there is not a self is an extreme view. So it's kind of one of these either, neither, neither, nor, you know, not one, not two kind of situations. So the Buddha is saying there's not a self and there's not a not self. That trying to sort of exclude or hold on to this idea of a self is a mistake. And so the non-self thinking, I think, shows up most obviously in spiritual practice. Maybe some kinds of psychology, maybe people who take drugs, a lot of drugs or something. If our idea is like to just get rid of the self, that's just manas too. So it's not creating and protecting the self, it's not getting rid of the self. Those both create suffering. He says in there, the Buddha, so here's what the Buddha suggested, he says. The Buddha, this is Thich Nhat Hanh speaking in page 99, the Buddha offered impermanence as an instrument for us to explore reality and discover the truth of non-self. Just as a flower is made up of non-flower elements, the self is made up of non-self elements. I am made of non-me elements. But manas is unaware of this. It continues to believe in the idea of a permanent eternal self. And so it is always separating and discriminating between what is self, what is not self. The only way to help manas stop grasping at the notions of self and not self is for us to practice deep looking into the impermanent and interdependent nature of reality. So that's pretty much Thich Nhat Hanh's standard thing that he says about everything. But, you know, he says it because it's true. That one of the ways to free ourselves from a fixed view is just to do a little logical exercise with ourselves and keep doing it and keep doing it until it gets through our thick skulls. That whatever thing we think we're experiencing or looking at or being is made up of other things. And, you know, as you kind of get finer and finer, you can say, well, this whole sort of body-mind thinking thing, that's me. Yeah, my body's me, yeah. Yeah, but when I trim off my fingernails, is that me, you know? No, that's not me. That's just, you know, blah, 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 you know. That's not me. So it kind of doesn't make sense, you know. It doesn't really hold water if you think about it, but it doesn't exactly stop us, you know.
Is it kind of the same idea that everything in the universe is what brought me to be right here, right now?
Yeah, exactly. That we're a sort of expression of all that, you know. And a temporary expression, kind of like a wave rising out of the ocean. Just like, you know, this is Connie for 8 decades and gone again, you know. We hope.
Not so fast.
So this manas is the little devil that keeps us
it's the little
off
devil.
Off
yeah.
The kilter and so forth, and it's, right. It reminds me of the brain research that says that the left side of our brain is the verbalizing mm-hmm. side, and the right side is the nonverbal, mm-hmm. but intuitive and has access, and it has access to symbology and all of that kind of thing. And so the translation of our experience, our direct experience, is through Manas, who is biased toward finding a self.
Mm-hmm.
So it keeps right. it keeps interrupting our just experiencing, just direct experience, because that's the way our brains work. They keep trying right. to translate everything into
right.
Concrete or verbal
yeah.
expressions.
Yeah. Well, I think that's true. I think we're kind of like our sort of conscious awareness is in here, and we could just kind of appreciate what's coming into the five senses, but we're getting kind of grabbed by something coming from down here. I don't know if it's inherently verbal or nonverbal. I think people vary, I think, myself and you, since we know each other so well, I think we're pretty verbal
yeah.
thinkers. Other people, I think the Manas kind of expresses more symbolically and more visually,
it's the translator.
But it's translating, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so it's
selecting.
A bias.
Yeah, it's a biased, yeah.
In
yeah.
my case, it's always to nail it down, and
yeah.
that just, screws
yeah.
it up. So.
Yeah, right. Exactly, yeah.
I was wondering about the Oriental translation. It's heart mind, not mind. So the mana seems to speak very much to the thinking, processing, computing part of the brain. And I was wondering for a moment if the arrows on the sides that are kind of curved are
mm-hmm.
more like the heart part,
mm-hmm.
but then Alaya Vishnana is everything, so it's the good and bad and the weird.
Mm-hmm.
So that doesn't quite hit it either. Is there anything you can add?
Well, there's several different words for mind being used here, and I don't know if any of them line up directly with, the Chinese character for heart-mind. So Vijnana is consciousness, Manas is one word for mind. So this is actually Manas Vijnana, so it's a kind of mind consciousness. I don't know if I remember the etymology, we should look it up. And this one actually in Sanskrit is Mano, M-A-N-O, Mano Vijnana. But mano sounds so weird to us that Thich Nhat Hanh, I think, smartly called that one. That's where he put the word mind. But I think in this frame, it's all these different kinds of mind, It's all these different sort of layers of mind with different kinds of function and different kinds of relationship, That this mind is the mind that stores these seeds, and kind of keeps them ready for presentation when needed. And this mind is the mind that does this kind of interaction between conscious awareness and the storehouse, and what's me, and what's me, and what's me, and what's me, And this mind is somehow taking all this stuff together and weaving it into some sort of sense of coherence, the senses, what's arising from the storehouse, thanks to Manas's selection. And like you say, some stuff that somehow sort of slips quietly around the edges there, which seem to be our most obvious experience of them being the kind of random thoughts that seem to come from nowhere and don't seem to have anything to do with self, Why did I think of that? So I don't know, Chris. Yeah, we could dig further into the different ways that they think about the mind, because I think the language is a little tricky.
Where would you put Buddha nature into this picture?
Buddha nature is that through practice, all this can be transformed. All this has potential for transformation into, like he said at the end of the last section, that this vast storehouse, which is sort of ethically neutral, actually through practice, through the nature, Buddha nature of it, can be transformed to the great mirror wisdom called pure consciousness. So I think the Buddha nature is that all of this has the possibility for transformation, all of it, no matter how sort of nasty it seems to us. Yeah. Alrighty, 18. Now there's a typo in your handout there. The object, it's supposed to be the object of manas is the mark of a self, not the object of means is the mark of a self. So the object, so the basis of manas, so everything in Buddhist psychology, everything has a basis and an object. They have a slightly different kind of take on subject objectivity. So the basis of Manas is the life of jnana, and the sense of the mark of self is the object that it holds on to. The object of Manas is the mark of self found in the field of representations at the point where Manas and store consciousness touch. So the field of representations, remember, it's back to this kind of weird different levels about, where did that go? Previous page. About perception. So Manas is always representational, he's saying. It can't really encounter anything directly, and maybe I don't totally understand how it relates to this third one of mirror images, but Manas is understanding things as representations. So it's always sort of a step away from any sort of experienced reality. It's representing things with, yeah, like you were saying, Edie, with language, with images, with something which is not actually reality. You know, none of it's real.
It's always a map.
It's a map. Yeah, that's a good way to say it. And yeah, it's always a map, yeah. Manas is giving us a map, you know. Maybe it's a map to happiness or a map to suffering, but it's the map, and it says to us, this map is you, you need to follow this map. If you don't follow this map, you aren't you anymore, and that's the most threatening thing that could ever happen, you know. Yeah, it's to not be you. That's like psychosis or death or something. So you don't want that. So, 19. Oh, actually, there's a little quote from Tagawa Roshi about this verse. The origin of all our confusion lies precisely within the relationship between alaya vijnana and manas. So that's a big statement. The origin of all our confusion. I always get interested when someone has the temerity to say all, you know. The origin of all our confusion lies within the relationship between alaya vijnana and manas. So something about the way manas is selecting for self is the generator of confusion. What do we do about that? It's down there below our conscious awareness, you know. Nothing very direct we can do about it. But it can also shift our attribution. It can shift our reinforcing of the attribution of self, right? To say, well, maybe I'm confused because alaya vijnana and manas are duking it out down there, you know. Maybe it's not just that I didn't pay attention or that I'm inadequate or, you know what I mean, that I'm not good enough, you know. Maybe there's another source of confusion here. So maybe that might arise. That would be a wholesome seed to arise. But, of course, that seed can only arise through the very same mechanism. So, 19. As the ground of wholesome and unwholesome of the other six manifesting consciousnesses, Manas continues discriminating. Its nature is both indeterminate and obscured. So that's a lot is packed in there. Let's read a little bit from Tinahan about what is meant there. I don't want to spend too long on it, but this indeterminate and obscured thing is actually important. Let's see. Page 107, I made a note that there was something of value, but does it relate to this directly? Now my seeds are arising again, like, did I get this right? Is this the right one? Oh, it's close enough. Yeah, the bottom of page 107 is interesting. He talks about, so this is talking about, well, how do we practice with all this? I don't know if we're going to get directly to the indeterminate and obscured, but... So when we come to a practice center, says Tidanhan, we bring our store consciousness and manas with us. Right, so... Everyone's bringing that. We all have that. And we receive seeds of the Dharma. Our mind consciousness sows these seeds into the store consciousness. We cannot hold the seeds of Dharma in our intellect, our mind consciousness. That's worth reading again, right? We cannot hold the seeds of Dharma in our intellect, our mind consciousness. We have to bring the teachings into our whole person and plant them in the soil of our store consciousness. Then, day and night, while walking, sitting, eating, drinking, and all our activities, we water those seeds with our mindfulness. And then, like he was saying before, so he repeats this theme several times in this book, that we need to have confidence, we need to have faith. That even though we're not necessarily consciously aware of it, even though the seeds that are manifesting the next day, the next year, 10 years later, are not the seeds we exactly wanted, you know, subjectively, like people often say, you know, can't believe I'm still doing this or thinking this, but I've been practicing this many years, it's ridiculous. which is, of course, planting a certain kind of seed. All right. But he says, "You know, sooner or later, quite naturally, we'll have a breakthrough." Quite naturally. It's going to happen. And then skipping a little bit, this is the second paragraph on page 108, second sentence. "If we only use our mind consciousness for mental gymnastics, we won't go very far. Many people keep the teachings they learn up in their mind consciousness, using their intellect to poke and prod at them. Even though they think about them and talk about them all the time, they never learn how to bring the seeds of the Dharma into the store consciousness and entrust them to the fertile soil." And I thought entrust was a very good choice of verb. And I have no idea if he wrote this or spoke this in English or somebody translated it or what, but entrust seems perfect. So we entrust our seeds, our wholesome seeds, our Dharma seeds. Now, I thought there was a thing in here about indeterminate and obscure. Oh, here it is.
That's in the previous chapter, maybe.
Yeah, actually, it's earlier in this chapter. I just got my page numbers mixed up. So this is the top of page 106. "The nature of manas," 106, sorry, "is indeterminate, like store consciousness." So we can't really determine its nature. "But it is also obscured by ignorance. Obscured means to be covered up. You cannot see the light if there is something covering it up." So when it said obscured by ignorance, remember ignorance is a very particular meaning in Buddhism. So now he explains that. Ignorance in Sanskrit is avijja, literally the absence of knowledge, knowledge being vijja. So avijja, a is a negation, avijja. So a lack of knowledge. "The veil of ignorance that covers manas is the tendency to discriminate between self and non-self. Indeterminate means neither wholesome nor unwholesome." Well, that's right, okay. So obscured means it's covered by ignorance. Indeterminate means it's neither wholesome nor unwholesome. So this is important. Okay, I know, I remember now. "This means that there's a possibility of transformation from clinging and discriminating to letting go and non-discrimination. The transformation of manas can happen because it's indeterminate. The earth can give rise to thorns and brambles, and it can give rise to fragrant fruit and flowers." Okay, so this is kind of like the answer to Chris's question earlier about Buddha nature. That manas is neither wholesome nor unwholesome. It's a function, it's an energy, you know. And the way kind of the track it's running down from birth and before birth is, you know, the track and the pattern of discrimination and selfing. And through practice and over time, you know, based on what the mind consciousness kind of whispers, now we need to whisper sweet nothings in its ear, you know, instead of gossiping, you know, through, you know, many kalpas, many decades of conscious practice and being aware of how we use our mind and how we respond to things, gradually manas can actually flip around to where it becomes, instead of an agent of self, an agent of non-discrimination and wholeness. So that's the Buddha nature of it, I suppose. Yeah, he doesn't really say Buddha nature in here, which is interesting. All right. Oh, we're getting bogged down, though. I'm going to blast a little bit here. Verse 20. "Manas goes with the five universals, with mati of the five particulars, and with the four major and eight secondary afflictions. All are indeterminate and obscured." So those numbers are talking about this list of dharmas in our handout. So not to dig too deep, but just to touch in. The five universals, these are mental factors that are available in all the consciousnesses. So manas has a way of doing attention and contact, having the pleasant, unpleasant feelings, perceiving, and manas has volition, manas has intention. So manas has access to all this. It's just, again, it's going down this initial sort of track, you know, towards separate self. And then it also relates to mati of the five particulars. And here, this is the kind of thing that where I get critical of Thich Nhat Hanh. He likes to rewrite Buddhism if he doesn't like the way we got it. You know? At least in here, he's fessed up. So the fifth of the five particular factors, insight, intelligence, and they use the Sanskrit word prajna, which means knowledge. But this particular prajna, this particular knowledge, is knowledge that is not inherently wise. It's knowledge that is often false. And so Tinahan says that's no good. Prajna means wise. So we're going to use a different word. We're going to use the word mati, which mati means knowledge that incorrect knowing, wrong knowing. So he just kind of changed the tradition there. Which, that's okay. We all do that.
Where's that?
Oh, I'm sorry. So we're on the 51 dharmas. Are you on that chart?
Yeah. But okay. What did you say about mati?
So look at the five particular factors. Uh-huh. Number five. Insight, intelligence, prajna with a little asterisk. Mm-hmm. And right below that, I put a footnote. Mm-hmm. Tidnahan, critical views of prajna, see page 110, prefers mati and tells a creepy story about a child whose father thought him dead. Did you read that story?
So mati is the bad...
Mati is fallible intelligence.
Fallible.
Mati is kind of a fallible intelligence. So that's so anyway, back to the point of the verse, the manas has all these useful tools in its toolbox. It can attend to things, it can make contact, it can notice how things feel, it can perceive, it can generate intentions, right? So that's good. But it's hampered because it's also associated with this kind of faulty intelligence that Tinahan is calling mati. And I that was probably a really unuseful little rant that I just gave you about prajna. But anyway, rant I did because a seed arose. Sorry, Tay, or Tai. Well, I'll tell you a little story. It's a good story. It's kind of gross, though. So the Buddha illustrates this quality of mati with a parable. Bottom of page 110. A man, the father of a little boy, went away for a few days, leaving his son at home. When he returned, he found his house had been burned down by bandits. He saw the charred remains of a child lying near the ruins of the house. And immediately he believed that this was the body of his little boy, and he threw himself on the ground, beat his chest in grief, overcome. The next day, he organized a funeral ceremony, collected the ashes, and put them into a beautiful silk bag. The man was very attached to his little boy, and he carried the bag of ashes with him wherever he went. What he didn't know was that his son was still alive. He'd been captured by the bandits. Sometime later, the boy was able to escape. In the middle of the night, he reached the house his father had rebuilt, knocked, and asked his father to open the door. The man, convinced his son was dead, became very angry and yelled, "Go away, don't disturb me, my son is dead." The child tried again and again to convince his father that he was his son, but the man's conviction that his son was dead was so strong that he wouldn't listen. The boy gave up and went away. And then doesn't say what happens next. So, yeah, then he talks about, you know, fanaticism and blind beliefs, and that's a kind of extreme story, but, you know, the point of such stories is to make us wonder, what are the mild ways that I'm doing that? What are the little ways that I'm holding a belief and then ignoring evidence to the contrary? And more or less, that is what the self is, you know. It's a strongly held belief, and we ignore the evidence to the contrary. So he's saying that manas is caught up in that. And then it's got a bunch of negative stuff going on too. So here's the other problem manas has, that it is the primary generator of the first four of the six major afflictions. And these are the kleshas. We've heard Kate talk about the kleshas before. So manas is associated with craving and ill will and pride and ignorance. And it's also associated with the first eight of the secondary afflictions. So it's into anger and resentment and concealing and hostility and jealousy, selfishness, deceitfulness, and guile. Lovely. But I don't totally understand this myself, actually, because it's very clear in these teachings that none of these dharmas only arise from seeds. So I don't know if it's that manas has a tendency to select these seeds when it's trying to reinforce itself based on its wrong view, or if manas is just like sort of attracted to those, or somehow manas has the quality of those dharmas. So I don't really understand that part.
I wonder if it's manas recognizes them.
Yeah, maybe manas sees those particularly clearly, like, oh, there it is, yeah.
Yeah.
Got it, yeah, cool. Yeah. So anyway.
You know, in a healthier set, manas would recognize the healthier.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, so yeah, maybe the project of practice is broadening manas's ability, you know, to see all the seeds, you know, with equanimity and be able to see the positive seeds that are there, you know, interplanted with these terrible things. That,
so, mm-hmm. Could you just briefly re-explain prajna? So is that the Sanskrit word that is in the verses?
Prajna, yeah, so prajna is the word for wisdom. or means wisdom or knowledge. Uh-huh. I think in pre-Buddhist Sanskrit it meant knowledge, and the Buddha cast it more as wisdom. And then in Mahayana Buddhism, when they got interested in emptiness, they came up with this term paramita, mm-hmm. which kind of means like to go beyond or imbued with the true nature of. So prajnaparamita that we chant, that's that same prajna, which is what set Tathagata off, I think. He's like, that's not it, you know. This is this other thing.
But it Monty. Actually is prajna. It's in the verses.
In the original teachings, they said in the list of dharmas from the Yogacara school, this one is called prajna. Yeah. So Tathagata's suggesting we revise the tradition.
So what do you think they originally meant? Whose version?
I don't know. I mean, it seems clear from context that Manas, you know, doesn't have a wise view, you know, when it's in this kind of initial setup. And prajna implies wisdom, so yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I mean, Tathagata doesn't explain the age. He's like, yeah, that's no good. They got that wrong. Yeah, he's pretty right, you know, I agree. You know? And which kind of brings up a bigger topic about translation and evolution of a tradition, and, you know, are we stuck? What if the ancestors made a mistake, right? That's like, of course, you know, of course they would, right? Do we change it? Do we wonder if we're just having a limited view based on, you know, this process that we don't get it yet? So it's hard to know. And what's good, I think, it's good that traditions have a bit of a conservatism around change, so we have to kind of take some time thinking about it, you know. Should I change the way, you know, we chant the precepts? Should we change this, that, or the other thing? It's good that we take some time with it, but ultimately it has to be a living tradition, right? Otherwise, what's the point, you know? So two more verses, and then I want to read you a little interesting essay about self, and then do an exercise. As shadow follows form, Manas always follows.